Even if you don't see deer on your travels through rural land, you probably see signs, either the literal ones indicating deer crossing or the physical signs of a deer that met grief on the bumper of a car or truck. It's not just deer. There are lots of animals that end up dead on the roads. The transportation and wildlife people are well aware of the situation and making efforts to keep the critters and the cars apart. Let's hear about wildlife corridors and more. We have two guests. Sydney Bowman is with ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, where she's the Wildlife Passage Program Leader. Sydney, welcome.
Thank you.
And Sarah Gregory is with us from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife at ODFW. She is a wildlife habitat biologist. Sarah, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Sarah, we're really in the heart of the season when we're most likely to see deer and elk around. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Especially deer. They've got a real set path that they follow between their winter and summer ranges, and they're very dedicated to getting there twice a year, so they're crossing the highways all around the state right now.
So this is their natural, this is when they do their moving.
Yep, migration.
Okay. So Sydney, this would then, I would assume, be the hot spot in the year for collisions between animals and vehicles?
Definitely. We see an increase in the density of wildlife vehicle collisions around the state, but definitely in certain corridors where we have a higher population of mule deer.
Is a mule deer one of the major major issues you have with any animal?
Yeah, we have a pretty large migration of mule deer in Central Oregon that crosses Highway 97 and Highway 31. So they have the longest migration in the state. So we definitely see more collisions in these areas this time of year.
How sharply does the rate go up?
Oh, I'd say we get probably the vast majority of our collisions this time of year, and we also have them in the spring. As Sarah said, they cross twice a year. So they tend to go up in the spring and fall.
All right. Are there any elk in here too, Sarah, or is it mostly just deer?
The elk are more of a year-round kind of thing. They migrate, but it's more in response to weather and that sort of thing. So you could see them any time of year.
So, Sarah, I would guess that over time, the animals that are capable of adapting to changing circumstances in their environment have grown wary of roads. But is this just the kind of thing where the imperative to get from where they spend the summer to where they get the winter is just that strong, it doesn't matter?
Well, the concern that we have is that as traffic volumes increase, animals won't try to cross anymore, and so they're effectively cut off from the habitat that they need to fulfill their life cycle.
Okay, that would be a problem.
Yeah.
All right, so ODOT has to work around them a bit, Sydney. Has the Wildlife Passage Program been around for a while?
It's been in existence for about 4 years. That's when Oregon decided that this is an issue that they needed to address and start to work towards solving. So we have 3 undercrossings around the state to try and address this issue and try and get animals across the highway without interfering with drivers.
Mm-hmm. 3 undercrossings, meaning that literally is like an underpass just for the animals?
Exactly, yes. A bridge, or large culvert that is designed to accommodate deer or elk, depending on the circumstance and where they're at, and get them to move underneath the highway instead of across the highway.
Now, what kind of, is it kind of like, I keep thinking in terms of highway construction itself. When you're trying to get cars to go certain ways, you have to build ramps and stuff for them. So what mm-hmm. kinds of amenities do you have to build to help guide deer, for example, to get to the undercrossing and use it?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have to include wildlife fencing that'll help direct the animals to the undercrossing. So that typically it's like an 8-foot tall fence that will guide, like I said, the animals to where we want them to cross.
All right, 8 feet tall. That's generally deer-proof, isn't it?
Yeah, yep.
All right, and then, Sarah, despite all this, I mean, is it hard to predict animal behavior to guide them to the places you want them to go?
Well, fortunately, in the case of mule deer, we've got a big pile of data from deer that we collared over about 8 years. And so, and also ODOT helps us out with collecting information on where they find roadkill. So we know where a lot of hot spots are, and we just try to be opportunistic when projects come along to incorporate those passage structures in those key areas.
So I'm curious about that. How many mule deer got collared over the years?
Well, it was a landscape scale kind of project all the way down to the California border from the Bend area, and we collared about 400 animals.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, too.
So were you out there for some of the collarings?
I was, yeah. I actually worked directly on the project for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And so how long does it take to go through the whole process of, I guess it's a tranquilizer dart fired from a gun or something?
Yeah. We used a helicopter to trap deer and then put the collar on them, and they wore the collar for about a year and a half before it dropped off. A little mechanism blows the collar off, and then we download the data and map it out and do all kinds of fun analysis. So,
if you got 400 deer collared, I imagine you mentioned having a big pile of data. So, I mean, how much more do you know now about deer movements than you knew before?
Well, we know where they winter, kind of the hot spots for winter areas and the summer, and then we developed these resource selection models that allow us to predict where on the landscape you might find a deer in the winter or the summer. And then these movement corridors, deer move in what we call a sheet migration, so it's not like a chain of deer following each other across the highway. It's more like each animal has, they're kind of more like walking side by side. But there are some pinch points due to topography and things like that where animals are crossing in higher numbers. So we just learned how to highlight those with the analysis that we did, and then teaming up with Sydney and other folks trying to advocate for wildlife crossings in those areas.
Sheet migrations sounds pretty understandable. I think what you're saying is they don't line up, so it basically moves across the land like a cloud in a sense.
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are talking about deer and cars, well, primarily deer and cars, but there are other animals involved here as well, and just about generally keeping wildlife and vehicles apart. Sarah Gregory is with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. She's a wildlife habitat biologist. Sydney Bowman is with ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation. She's the Wildlife Passage Program Leader. Join the conversation on the exchange. Questions, comments, thoughts about what's going on out there between vehicles and critters. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Sarah, were other pinch points about what you'd expect when you looked at the data from the collared mule deer, that, you know, just topographical features that tend to narrow the stream of animals into more thin lines?
Yeah, for the most part. And, you know, we were happy to see that I hate to say happy when talking about deer dying on the highway, but that the hot spots that we found for our collared animals lined up with what we were seeing from ODOT's data. So we could rely on ODOT's carcass collection when they found roadkill deer to say, okay, here's, you know, in the future when we don't have deer collared, to say, here's where we're having trouble, you know, keeping deer alive on the highway.
Well, so this raises the question, Sydney, for ODOT. I mean, it's been longer than the 4 years that the Wildlife Passage Program has existed that there have been deer crossing signs out there. So there must have been some sort of general knowledge already available before this data about where deer tended to cross the road.
That's true. Yeah, we do have, as Sarah mentioned, our maintenance crews, when they have to remove animals from the road, they track that. So we had some existing data, and you're right, it's not a new problem that's unique to Oregon. But the collar data does give us some more certainty about where actual corridors are and maybe areas also where animals have ceased moving because they've died out from collisions or other causes. So it gave us more information to be sure that if we're going to make big investments, that they're in the right place.
So, Sarah, if they cease moving, as Sydney just said, I mean, what happens if they're not moving to the places they really need to be? Do they just die where they are?
Well, over the long haul, deer will stop, they'll adjust their migratory path, or they'll become more what we call residential deer, where they don't exhibit that migratory behavior. And what we found in looking at some of our survival analysis is that deer that migrate have a higher chance of surviving long term than deer that don't. So we really want to maintain that migratory behavior and habit.
Did the residential succumb to disease, to predation, to both?
Oh, all kinds of things. We've got problems with illegal harvest, disease, all of those things that you just mentioned. There's a whole gamut of things that kill deer out there on the landscape, unfortunately.
Now, Sarah, you mentioned that the collaring of the mule deer took place from Bend all the way down to the California border. Is the major issue for cars versus deer in Central Oregon, Sydney?
Oh, that's one of the areas. We have other corridors, the John Day area down in southwest Oregon near Roseburg, up between Medford, Grants Pass, and Klamath Falls are other areas where we have high density of collisions. So it's one of many, but the 97 corridor, I think, as we mentioned earlier, has the largest mule deer migration. So that's sort of been the focus to keep those animals moving.
You mentioned the three undercrossings that ODOT has built, and I was looking at the stuff. In fact, I actually printed the sheet that shows the the amenities you put in place around lava lands in Central Oregon on and near US 97. That's quite a project. Can you break out for the listeners what the components of that are?
Sure. So Highway 97, south of Bend, near Sun River, for folks that have been there, went from a two-lane highway to a four-lane divided highway. So there was the opportunity when they expanded the highway to put in two wildlife undercrossings that were designed for deer, but also accommodate a whole suite of other species. So in addition to the undercrossings, we put in 4 miles of that wildlife fencing. And we also included, you know, anytime you have a break in the fence, you have to have make sure that animals don't get onto the highway, so on-ramps or off-ramps. So we have these electromats that are in place to keep animals on the wild side of the fence in those openings. And we also have jump outs at the fence ends in case an animal goes around the fence ends and finds themselves on the highway. There's a way for them to jump back onto the wild side of the fence. So it's not just the undercrossing. You have to have some of those other features as well in case animals do find themselves on the highway still.
Tell me about those electric mats.
Yeah, so they're designed to give like a mild shock to the animal so it deters them from crossing onto the highway. So
wow,
we call them electromats.
All right. So, and how well have the amenities worked? I mean, based on design, I mean, have they worked about as you planned?
We've had, you know, because these were our first two we had in Oregon, there's definitely been a learning curve, and there's been some things that we've had to learn with those electromats. Like, they were designed in Arizona where they don't have as much snow as we do. So we've had to kind of adapt some of our management and make sure that we keep them clear of snow and things like that. But for the most part, they've worked pretty well. We've learned a lot. So the next time we do this, we'll take those lessons learned and apply them to future projects.
And what's the price tag for all the features around that lava lands crossing?
Not cheap. It's about $2.5 million maybe at that time for 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes the two undercrossing bridges, the electromats, the fencing, and those jump outs. So they're not inexpensive, but they do pay for themselves over time. Just if you've ever been in a car accident with an animal, it's not cheap. You know, you often have to repair your car if it's not totaled, and there can be hospital bills as well. So as a benefit to society, they pay for themselves in about 12 to 15 years.
And did it require any special allocation from the legislature or anything, or was this money ODOT was able to allocate from somewhere within its budget?
Well, because there's all these different pots of money, but because that Lava View project was a new modernization project, get certain funds that other projects aren't eligible for. The Wildlife Passage Program is unfunded.
Okay.
Currently, so we had to be pretty opportunistic and
unfunded. There's no funding for Wildlife Passage at all.
There isn't. No, we really rely on. We have really strong partnerships, and then trying to find external federal money that could incorporate Wildlife Passage or these really big ODOT projects that are able to get special money.
So how much federal money is available? I know other states are working on things like this. I think everybody's seen on Facebook the overcrossings that Alaska has, which are very expensive, but it might indicate that there's some money out there to be doing this in many places.
Yeah, there is a federal grant that is specifically for Wildlife Passage that every 2 years it's available on public land. So you have to be on Forest Service or BLM. But it's also very competitive. You know, as you can imagine, there's lots of projects that take place on our forest where the forest and highways coincide. So there is money, but it's a competitive environment. So
when you were describing the three undercrossings, Sydney, are two of those at that lava lands area?
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
And the other one is west of Corrales between the Pioneer Mountain and Eddyville.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a very large culvert that was designed for elk. So again, that was a new highway, so they were able to get special funding for that undercrossing for that location.
Okay, it sounds like it certainly helps when you're planning highways to go ahead and put in for the animal crossing at that point.
Definitely, that's the way to do it. And we try not to do standalone projects for Wildlife Passage. We try and piggyback onto a highway project just to be more efficient with those funds.
And what about those overcrossings like the kind that Alaska has? I mean, are those just hideously expensive?
They are much more expensive. You know, Washington's building a handful. They are more effective, we think, for wildlife, especially if you have certain, like bears tend to be, will use them more than an undercrossing. So it depends on your species. And, you know, every state has different rules regarding freight mobility and things like that. So we hope to have one in Oregon, but we're not there yet.
We're talking about trying to keep cars and trucks and animals separate in Oregon with Sydney Bowman from ODOT and Sarah Gregory from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So, Sarah, as amenities are figured out, you know, things like electric pads and undercrossings and fences and stuff, I mean, are there tweaks that get recommended by wildlife biologists like yourself to say, you know, this is really more narrow a place than they might walk through, or you need to do this to make it a little more comfortable for them, that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as each project is installed, we monitor animal use with cameras, and we get, you know, the animals kind of tell us what they're willing to use in terms of the height of the undercrossing, the jump outs that Sydney mentioned that get the animals back on the wild side, on the other side of the fence. The height of those can influence whether an animal uses, you know, a small deer like a fawn may not want to jump 6 or 7 feet down, whereas a buck may be okay with that. So we're learning as we go, like Sydney said. It's all in the testing phase, really. It's an interesting field to be in.
Oh, I bet. Are there a lot of things you still don't know about deer behavior? I ask this because, you know, in Ashland, where the deer seem to roam all over town, they'll just take off like bullets sometimes. And you wonder why, and just
we haven't figured that out yet. But we do. I mean, there's more and more research coming out. There was just some research that came out that confirmed kind of what we were suspecting about how deer learn their migratory paths, and it's from their mothers, you know, the young ones following their mothers each in their first year of life, essentially.
So do you do any work to try to influence the behavior of the mothers to try to make sure that the next generations get steered a certain way?
Well, that's what the fencing is a huge part in getting animals accustomed to using those undercrossings, and we believe that as deer get funneled that way, that they'll just naturally go under the undercrossing and not have to navigate the fence. So, I mean, it wouldn't negate the need for the fence. We'd always need the fence, but we think animals are going to learn over time how to use those structures a little more effectively.
Sydney, given the lack of permanent funding, it sounds like, for the Wildlife Passage program that you lead, and the fact that there are so many miles of road and so many deers, you can really just affect a small portion of the landscape, it sounds like.
Yeah, we're trying to increase that. Like I said, we have some really strong partnerships with the hunting groups and Oregon Wildlife Foundation, ODFW, that we're really trying to get a strategy together to perhaps get a set pot of money that we can pull from to address this issue. Really, and also just raising awareness for the public to know this is a problem that they need to be aware of and concerned with.
We have talked mostly about deer. Is anybody even a close second in the animal kingdom to concerns about animals versus roads?
Well, definitely elk. If you hit an elk, you're going to know it.
Right.
You probably have some pretty big damage. So for ODOT, we're definitely more concerned with the safety aspect of drivers hitting wildlife. I'm sure there's other species, listed species and smaller species that don't get quite the attention they deserve. But because they're not a safety issue, ODOT hasn't been as focused on those species. That's the benefit of these wildlife undercrossings. Even though they're designed for deer, we see about 30 species that will use them and benefit from them. So,
okay, lots of users then. Great. We'll keep track of the program and try to talk to you in the future and see if you got more funding. Sydney Bowman leads the ODOT Wildlife Passage Program. Sarah Gregory is a wildlife habitat biologist with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you both for joining us today on The Exchange.